Survey flying is probably one of the less talked about types of flying, or at least in the circles I was in, it's something we didn't talk about too much. We had an interview earlier this summer about aerial mapping, which ties into survey flying, a very similar type of work. And for 3 seasons, I flew for a company called Clearwater. Started off the Northern Commanders, and then it turned into Clearwater. And that was marine mammal surveys. And you're working closely with biologists. It's actually a really pretty cool type of flying. There's a fair amount of standby time. You're waiting on weather and, you know, circumstance. Weather and wind were kind of the things we were waiting on a lot. I imagine different surveys, you're going to have different types of conditions you need to be met before you can fly them. And it was interesting that earlier this summer I had a chance to meet up with Stan Churches, who I flew with at Clearwater, and he's now the chief pilot for Clearwater Air. And he was up in Nome flying some surveys out near St. Lawrence Island. And they actually had upgraded quite a bit from when I flew for them. They'd done some good work on the airplanes. They were flying Commander 690s, which is a turbine, super fast plane, really designed to fly, you know, high from point to point. And they're flying them down lower, anywhere from, well, it depends. They get low-level surveys where you might be doing a couple hundred feet, and then all the way up to, you know, 1,000, 1,500 feet would be about as high as you go on most of those surveys. The company also has a float plane they use for surveys down in the southeast. So it can be very diverse for a pilot. And anyway, it's great for me to be able to sit down with Stan and sort of catch up on where that company's went, what they're looking for in pilots, and what he was doing, what his life as a Clearwater pilot is. So I hope you enjoyed the interview. This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm sitting down with Stan Churches. Stan's the chief pilot of Clearwater Aviation or Clearwater Air?
Clearwater Air.
Clearwater Air. And Stan and I worked together in Barrow when Oddball Pilot first started. He was there for the first interview with the Twin Otter pilots in the hotel room in Barrow, and then he held the camera for the Twin Otter aircraft walkthrough that we shot. And it's pretty cool to see Stan again here in Nome. And he actually took the job that I had for Clearwater at the time. But Stan had been flying for years and years before I ever flew with him in the Commander. So we're going to talk to Stan about what Clearwater does, mainly animal surveys, and a little bit about Stan's career like we usually do to get some background on the story. So, Stan, let's just kind of start out with, you know, when you first got into aviation and why you got into aviation.
Well, I, you know, like most kids, I always was interested in flying, and, you know, I always thought it was cool. But when I was 17, this was back in 1978.
It's always good to date ourselves.
Yeah, what the heck, you know. My dad actually gave me a Christmas present of $500 worth of flying at the local FBO in Salmon, Idaho.
Awesome. Yeah, you grew up in Idaho.
Yep. And so I went down there, didn't know squat, and started taking lessons. And I remember back then the flight instructor was $8 an hour, and the 152 was 150, it was $15 an hour.
Oh, that's changed a little bit.
Yeah. And so I got about 30 hours of flying in, and the money ran out, and, you know, I got into hot cars and chicks and didn't want to spend my money on flying at that point. But so I did a bunch of different jobs, building houses, driving truck and whatnot. And then my grandma called up one day and asked if I was interested in going to college. And I'd been out of high school for a couple of years at this point and wasn't thinking about college.
Screwing around, having fun.
Yeah, I was just having a good time, making lots of money. But I knew that wasn't going to last forever, you know. And she said if I got all the loans and grants and stuff that I could, she would pay for the rest of my college. And I went to Walla Walla College, got a degree in aviation because I knew I wanted to fly.
Yep.
And so I went and got all my ratings there.
That's in Eastern Washington.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. And got out of there, got a job flight instructing at Fort Lewis, Washington, by Tacoma.
Yep, with the military, with the Army.
Yeah, I was a civilian, it was a military flying club, and I was a civilian contractor.
Okay.
And so tons of students just right there. The military gives them a really good deal on their flying. So I had from the lowliest private up to a full bird colonel, I think, was my student deal. And we also, McCord Air Force Base is real close. Now they're actually a joint base today, but back then they were still separate.
Yeah, we did some live fires on their land when I was in the Marine Corps.
Okay.
I'm just going to touch this real quick because we got one of our guys on the Oddball Pilot Network who's instructing at McCord out of Anchorage. Is it McCord out of Anchorage?
No, it's Elmendorf.
Elmendorf. So he's the same thing, a civilian contractor, yeah. And it sounds like a really good gig.
It was a good deal. It was funny because you'd get guys from McCord that were, you know, F-4,
yeah,
F-15 jocks that you know, they'd come up through the military, never flown civilian. They weren't checked out in a single engine land. They were military rated, and they wanted to get a license civilian wise so they could take their girlfriends and wives and stuff
right.
for a flight.
Yep.
And so they'd come in like the cock of the rock, you know, beep, you know. But
what's my flight deck angle?
Yeah, but you know, a 150 is not overpowered like an F-15. And you do actually have to use the rudders. And
no one ever accused a 150 of being overpowered.
So I usually had good luck doing Dutch rolls. You know, you keep your nose straight down the road, rock your wings back and forth without letting your nose wander around.
Ryanair's big on those. It's the only place I've flown where every check ride we do Dutch rolls.
And that takes the sassy right out of a fighter jock, and now he's ready to learn to fly a putt-putt.
Right, right.
Because it's like,
you know? What the hell?
Well, damn it.
So, F-15, you just do this. And
yeah,
stays.
Yeah, they don't need rudders. But it was fun. You know, you had a wide variety of students. And I did that for a couple years. And then actually a friend of mine that I went to college with was flying a single-engine mail run, bank mail, between Reno, Tonopah, and Eureka, Nevada.
Okay, yep.
And their mountain ranges pretty much go north and south through the desert. And you get by Austin, Nevada, and there's a pretty tall mountain range. A lot of times tough to get over when the weather was low.
And bad winds and turbulence,
yeah,
too.
And all that. And he actually had his girlfriend and a passenger and $150,000 of Round Mountain gold mine on board. And he apparently tried to go up a canyon and through a sucker hole to get over the mountains, flying a 182RG, and couldn't outclimb the mountain. And NTSB almost looked like he made it a 180 turnaround, but he stalled out, hit the mountain, and went skidding all the way down it and killed everybody. So there was a job opening. And they called me up and wanted to know if I was interested in doing that. And yeah, steady flying, paid better. So I packed everything up and moved to Reno and started flying this mail run.
What, and a 182?
182 and a 206.
Okay.
And it was VFR only type of a run. And it was some crazy flying. You know, I got there during pretty close during the summer, and they told me to fly real low and get used to all the area and stuff, because when winter comes and the ceilings drop, you're out there, and no kidding, I was out there in quarter mile in fog with two notches of flaps following the roads, under the power lines, over the cars, trying to, you know, get this run done, and which is okay during the day if you know the route real well.
We'll call that a metaphorical quarter mile.
Yeah, yeah, it looked like a quarter of a mile. It was probably three.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. Uncontrolled airspace, so at least a mile, clear of the clouds.
At least, yeah. But, that is a long time
ago. Yeah, this is a long, long time ago. And then nighttime had come, and you're trying to do that.
Yeah.
Following tail lights of cars, and they'd disappear. You turn on the landing light, and it was like Star Wars. You're in a big snowstorm. And,
yeah, yep.
You know, that was, it was nuts. But
which highways were you following? Just drive that area all the time.
Well,
next snowstorm, I'm looking for the airplane.
Interstate 80 goes out of Reno, and you're flying towards Fallon.
Yep.
And then you'd go around the highway that went through the around the Fallon Navy Range. It's actually through there.
Okay.
And there was a portion through the what was it, restricted area 16 north and south or whatever. And there was a VFR corridor. You had to be between 2 and 4,000 feet AGL through this corridor.
Huh.
And because the planes could fly under you or over you. And I remember coming through that along that corridor at night, and the Navy planes were, I could see them coming in over me and dropping down onto the firing center, pulling up, and then bombs would go off. Yeah, nighttime live fire.
So you didn't want to stray too far.
No, you wanted to stay right on course. But did that for about a year, and then I got on flying charters and stuff for Reno Flying Service.
They still around?
Actually, they're still around, but different. Oh, they're a different company now.
Right.
Mercury Air Center bought them out, and then they went back. Somebody else bought them from Mercury and turned it back into Reno Flying Service. And gone through some hands.
Standard aviation story.
Oh yeah. You know that how to make a big fortune in aviation and start with a small one.
Yeah. Or how to small
one start with a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's like that, but. Yeah, so I was flying charters and then started getting some time in twin engine charters, and then I did flew air ambulance. That was actually the first time I flew the 690. Was back in the 80s doing air. Well, actually, I hauled freight between Reno and Las Vegas in a 690, a 681, which is turbine commander.
Okay, yep.
And I took my ATP check ride in that 681. Yep.
That's a high-speed plane and, for a check ride.
Yeah, it was an intense check ride. But and then did air ambulance in them. And, let's see.
So you've been flying the 690 for a long time.
I started flying back in the 80s in a 690.
So when you were flying with me, you were thinking, what the hell is this idiot doing in the last seat?
You know, at this point, it's not pretty easy.
You're like, I can fly with any idiot.
I fly just as good from the right seat as I do from the left seat.
That's what TJ says, too, whenever we're flying together.
But, so, let's see, after that, then I got my first jet job there. I was 28 years old at this time, and the chief pilot that I'd worked for at Reno Flying Service had quit and taken a job flying for a Part 91 guy in a Hawker, and they came up. They wanted a third pilot, and he liked my work ethic and all that. Back then, I was gung ho. I mean, I was lived and ate and crapped aviation. You know, my spare time was at the airport helping mechanics wrench on planes and you know, putting wax and polishing these old freighter turds, and I would just loved it, you know.
Yeah, that was me in my 20s, too.
Yeah, so.
You get over it.
You get over it.
Not so, that you don't still work hard, but.
Oh, no, you would still work hard, but, you know, you don't just dream about flying all the time, either.
Yeah, you got other projects. Just a quick question before we go into the jet job. Were you thinking, like, towards airlines now? Did you have, like, an idea of what you wanted to do with an aviation career?
Yeah, you know, I thought about airlines and, you know, of course, the lure of the big money and, you know, all of that and the schedule and whatnot.
Uniform.
But I just got a 2-year degree.
Okay.
And statistically, there's only 2% of airline pilots that have less than a 4-year degree.
Yeah.
So, and a buddy of mine had no college degree, and he got on with United, you know, at 15,000 hours. And, in fact, that's who I used to fly the freight with in the 681 and stuff when I was learning, getting checked out in that. And, but he's the only one I know that didn't have a 4-year degree. And I didn't want to go back to school, and I just wanted to fly.
Yeah, and you're having fun so, doing what you were doing.
Yeah, and so the airline thing never happened, I think, mainly because of that.
Cool.
And I'm kind of glad it didn't. I got a lot of friends with the airlines, like everybody that's been in this game for a while does, and you know, it's a boring job.
Yeah.
And
it's a good job.
It's a good job, but it's a job. It's not an adventure anymore. Right. It's not something new and different. It's point A to point B. You're a bus driver.
IFR, ILS, ILS.
Yeah, all structured, you know. You don't do any paperwork. They hand it all to you done. It's like
it's easy.
Yeah, it's super easy. And, you know, we've all jump seated. The guys I've jump seated with, they hit 400 feet and the autopilot comes on and Wall Street Journal comes out and they're just checking stocks and it's like, oh, time to land. Okay. And you don't get a bulk of time off. Most of them I know are, you know, 4 days on, 2 days off, another 5 days on, 3 days off.
Yep.
Not enough time to really do anything.
Yeah, I hear you.
And the jet deal, I flew corporate jets for 12 years and all over the world.
What jets did you fly?
I got type rated in a Hawker series, and I flew a Hawker 800 and a Falcon 50. And I flew a Fokker F-28.
Oh, nice.
But didn't get a type in that. Went through the sim school, and the lead pilot that was in charge of that operation told, it was actually for Millionaire out of Salt Lake.
Okay, yep.
And he told him, he says, man, this guy flies the plane better than I do, just give him his type rating. And they didn't want to do that for some reason.
Yeah, some companies hold up.
So, but, you know, we'd trade seats and, you know.
Fly.
It's a super easy airplane.
And that, you went international with the corporate flying.
The corporate flying it did. Yeah. We went, we'd been up to Alaska with it.
Yeah.
And down to Lima, Peru, I guess, as far south as we went. And been over to England.
Cool. I've got a guy I used to work with in Bethel who I found through the website again, actually, and he went and flew air ambulance in China. Now he's over in Saudi flying a beach jet, I think. I kind of want to get to him about that whole, but that whole corporate international thing is a whole different world.
It wasn't bad. We used back then, and I'm sure they're still in business, a company called Universal.
Okay, yep. They're still in business.
Flight stuff, and, you know, all it takes is money.
Yeah.
And they set everything up. They got their own handlers to walk you through the customs immigration stuff, and it's slipping of the palms and grease your skids for you, and you sail right through. Flight plans all there down to the second. I mean, they're really accurate.
When I was ferry flying, I was always jealous. You'd watch the corporate jet, and they'd get up the little car, meet them, and we'd be standing there on the ramp for 30 minutes wondering what we're supposed to do. Like, damn it, just a little more money.
I know.
We'd get some help.
Makes it really easy. So, you know, it wasn't a problem.
So you ended up, and I'm kind of moving along, but I want to get to what you're doing now, and I know you've got some time crunches here. You did the jet stuff. You also ended up going back and flying the backcountry in Idaho.
I did that one summer for McCall.
Okay, and that was back home, your stomping grounds.
Yep. Actually did, I went from the corporate flying, and my last corporate job was flying a Hawker 800 for Thiokol Corporation out of Utah. They're the company that builds the solid rocket boosters for the space shuttle.
Cool.
And, you know, I replaced a guy that had retired after 30 years in that flight department.
Wow.
They'd had a flight department of some sort or another since, I heard, like 1929. I mean, way back. These guys had always had airplanes, always had a flight department. They had an age 60 mandatory retirement. And so the other two captains that I was working with were in their mid-50s, later 50s. Within 4 years, they would have had to retire.
Yeah, and you're looking at moving up and staying.
I'm looking up and hiring some buddies, you know, and retiring there like everybody else, and paid excellent, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, no deductible. I mean, it was a red carpet company.
Yeah,
it was top shelf. And 2 years after I got there, they sold out to Alcoa Aluminum out of Pittsburgh, and Alcoa shut the flight department down.
Oh.
there is no guarantees in aviation.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's actually, I just talked to someone, a friend who was at Pan Am, thought they'd made it. Pan Am went out of business. Mm-hmm. They went to Eastern.
Eastern
went out. I might have the order wrong on that. But
yeah, but it's like that, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd had enough of corporate. And so my next job was actually, I went back to fly an air ambulance out of Steamboat Springs, Colorado in a 421.
Okay.
Okay, so I go from Falcon 50 glass cockpit, Hawker 800 glass cockpit, back to steam gauge piston pounding 421.
Well, see, that would probably make me happy. I like the steam gauges. I like the smaller planes.
It was, well, a 421
geared
at 7,000 foot altitude, 4,500 foot runway, 100 degrees in the middle of the summer.
Yeah, you've got, those are the geared.
You don't worry about
shock cooling them, though, which I know guys are worried about.
But you still can.
Okay.
But, so you still have to be careful there, but it's fairly underpowered for that environment.
Yeah, yeah.
If you lose an engine, everything forward, everything up, feather, and follow the drainage down to Hayden, you know, because you ain't going to keep flying.
Yeah.
So, but then we upgraded to a E90 King Air, which is actually a really good airplane.
Okay.
For that environment.
That would be
2 years after, and I was doing a 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off.
Oh, sweet.
So I would go up there and do my 2 weeks, and it was on a pager.
Yep.
And they had a deal with their POI that said, you know, my duty time didn't start until the pager went off. So I went back to pounding nails. I was actually doing finished carpentry work during the day for a local contractor, and I was installing garage doors and stuff, working under the table. And with the understanding that if my pager goes off, I'm just going to drop my bags in. So I got a split. But and it wasn't real busy. And I did that for 2 years.
That seems like I've been looking at air ambulance a bit, too, and I don't have any real interviews on it. But air ambulance, you have a fair amount of time of your own time. And some have you standing by at the airport, sort of, but this was one of the gigs where you had a pager.
Yep. And so I had a pager, didn't have to be at the airport. And I've done the ones where you do have to be at the airport.
Yeah.
I've got probably 8 years of flying air ambulance under my belt. Off and on.
You liked it pretty well?
It was actually one of my favorite gigs.
Okay.
Just because of the satisfaction. I mean, when you help save, especially a kid's life,
you know,
this kid is going to die.
Yeah.
And you get him to help, and your parents come and thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're thinking about kids.
Yeah.
But a super, super job satisfaction.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's sitting around, you're bored to death. You know, not nothing going on. 12 hours on, 12 hours off.
Yeah.
My favorite schedule is a week on, a week off.
Yeah.
We would do 7/12s during the day.
Yeah.
We'd have our week off, and then we'd go back and do 7/12s on the night shift.
Oh, nice. I found an outfit in Bend that does it almost exactly that.
I know the guys in Bend.
Yeah.
One of my good friends just quit as their head deal.
Oh, really?
Start flying Learjets now. But,
nice gig, though.
Yeah, and they're,
It's more of the air ambulance stuff now. More of it's just patient transfer. Between hospitals.
The helicopters are on the scene.
Right, yep.
And then depending on what it is, like say I flew out of Richland and Spokane, the last air ambulance gig that I did, and if they had a guy that got severely burned, I mean, they'd go grab him, get him stable. We'd throw him in the airplane and run him up to Seattle, where they specialize in burns.
Yeah, that's what I've seen. But when I was looking in this, hospitals have started, it's not cost-efficient for Spokane to have a really good burn unit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's better for them to have a plane available that can get the patient to Seattle.
And now doing the deal out of Steamboat, Colorado's got a lot of little places that just have basic EMT stuff. It's too far for a helicopter to get to. I have done deals where I've flown into Podunkville, Colorado, and met a basic EMT unit where this 17-year-old kid in a car accident, his arm was torn off, basically hanging by a couple ligaments, and they had him bandaged up, and he was still bleeding all over, and stuffed him in the airplane and flew him to Denver. So that's as close to, like, on-the-scene stuff I've been to.
Pretty close.
And flew when I was flying an air ambulance out of Reno. I remember one time flying into Tonopah, and it was a car accident. And they brought this gal, and they had this stretcher, so it was sitting up. And her face was wrapped up a bit, and she was holding this gelatin little hunk of something in a rag. And we had to load her. Well, it turns out that thing that she was holding was her lower jaw with all the teeth knocked out of it. And she had, like, little black specks on her face and stuff. Yeah. And I thought somebody must have hit her with a shotgun.
Yeah.
But it was a car wreck, and the steering wheel ripped her lower jaw off.
Oh.
But we flew her to Reno, and they fixed her up in plastic surgery, and she's gave us a thank you thing, and she's all better, you know?
Yeah, without the aircraft transfer.
Without the aircraft, she probably wouldn't have survived.
Okay.
And if she did, she'd been totally disfigured, you know, by the time you drive that far to get to a hospital that can take care of you. Yeah. So you're performing a real crucial service. It's not like corporate jobs where you're flying some rich puke to his golf game, and, you know, it's not, you know, delivering freight that is not, you know, I mean, a lot of times it gets critical.
Right.
Especially in this neck of the woods.
Right. We like delivering freight.
Yeah. but anyway, it's just the schedule, the job satisfaction, the
pretty high,
the interaction with good crews and teamwork, you know, it's a great gig. I love it.
Huh. Cool. So that's Air Ambulance.
That's Air Ambulance.
How'd you end up here in Alaska flying for Clearwater?
Well, the company that I was flying Air Ambulance for decided to get rid of their King Air 200s and go to single-engine Pilatus.
Okay.
And I just feel like I've used up a lot of my mojo over the years.
Too.
And flying a single-engine airplane, nighttime, IFR, through the ice, over the Cascades and the Bitterroot Mountains is stupid. You know, I'm just telling you.
Yeah.
Because in my career, I've had to shut down 3 jet engines before.
Right. Engines do quit.
Compressor stall, oil pissed out, and you're going to weld it together or shut it down.
Yeah.
So you had no choice.
Right.
Yeah, but it was okay because I had 1 or 2 extra.
Right, yeah.
And those are jet engines, which are even more reliable than turboprop engines because you don't have prop seals and governors and all that junk on them.
You know the joke about the F-16?
Uh-huh.
The F-16's talking to a C-130 pilot. He's boasting about how great the F-16 is, and the C-130 guy says, "Oh, yeah, but can you do this?"
Yeah.
And the Herc just keeps flying along. Nothing's happening. The F-16 guy's like, "Well, what the hell? You didn't do anything." It's like, "Oh, we just shut one down."
Yeah, now there you go. So I'm a big fan of redundancy.
Yeah.
And if you, in fact, when they were talking about this, I did a bunch of research, NTSB stuff, and then worldwide data that you can get your hands onto. And you and I both know you probably lose an engine and nobody will ever find out because you happen to get back where it was and you're not going to report it. And,
right, yeah.
You know, so how many have been lost that nobody knows about and dead-sticked her on and had their mechanic come wrench it back together and never got reported, who knows?
Right.
But of the reported ones during this time period, there's like 734 turbine engines that have taken a crap in a 2-year period that I looked at. Worldwide.
Yeah, and that's a turbine, not a...
That's a turbine.
Yeah.
And you can't go by, "But I've never lost one," and, "Well, we never lost one." Well, guess what? I've flown pistons for thousands of hours, and I've never lost a piston engine.
Right.
And I've had to shut down 3 turbines.
Yeah.
Does my experience mean anything? Well, not really. You have to look at the big picture.
Yeah.
And a turbine engine's a mechanical device, And guess what? Sooner or later, a mechanical device is going to break.
Right.
It's not a matter of if. It's a matter of when and to who.
Right, and to who. That's the...
So, yeah, you could be lucky all your life.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's going to happen to
right.
somebody sooner or later, and I didn't want to be that one that it happens to.
And it might be someone in a plane that you just got out of and they got back.
Exactly.
And happened to them.
So to save a few bucks, you know, and go to a single-engine airplane in that kind of environment.
Right.
You know, the Midwest, flat, airport every 20 miles.
Yeah.
Okay. But... in the Northwest, over the mountains, through the ice at night, that's freaking stupid in my book.
Right.
And I know a lot of people do it, but I didn't want to do that.
Right. And the Platt is the great plane. But like
it is a great plane.
It's still
except for that one huge glaring
problem
defect.
There's
you know?
One.
Yeah. I mean, it's a well-built airplane. They glide great, although they do not glide great when they have ice on them.
Okay.
You know, and you will find no specs. I went through the whole school. This was a Plattis NG, next generation.
Yep.
Glass, beautiful, you know. But, you know, they don't even come out with numbers on, you know, you go in a King Air sim, that's a level C sim, and they can put ice on it, and
right.
they know what it flies like.
Right.
And you can see your degradation in performance.
Right, it's going to be high.
They don't even put ice in the Plattis on the sim.
They don't want
you to see that.
They don't want that info out.
No, it'll fly like a smartly thrown anvil. So, you know.
I'm pretty big. I can throw an anvil a long way.
and your source of de-ice boot, you know, on your one engine just quit. So you're going to load up, you're going to come down, and that's it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't want to be there. So we're not together anymore.
So you're back. So you did, and then you dug up.
So then I answered an ad. I saw online at climbto350.com, and Gary Brown was the chief pilot at Northwest Commander.
I've been emailing him a little bit.
Whatever, and he was looking for somebody with 690 time and Alaska time, and I had that and went to work for him, and then Andy got the company after that season and figured I knew how to fly and stayed on. And for me, you know, it's the next best thing.
Right.
To the air ambulance because of the schedule.
Yeah.
And I choose to work, you know, basically 6 months straight.
Right, and then the winter off.
And I take all winter long off and goof off.
Yeah.
And if I was greedy, I could drum up some more work during the winter. But when, you know, I'm coming up on 53 years old and probably am never going to be able to really retire. So I'm taking my retirement now, 6 months at a time.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, life's not all about work. It's not all about money.
You need the time off.
I've had lots of money and no time to enjoy it.
And
you know, my kids are grown. My schedule wouldn't work for a young family, somebody just starting out that's got little kids at home.
That they have to be there every night.
One of my regrets is, you know, doing corporate stuff when my kids were small, and I'd be gone 2-3 weeks at a time.
Yeah.
I missed out on a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so, but for all my kids are grown and supporting themselves. And
you can do this.
I can live my life now.
Yeah.
However I want.
Gary, he found us through the website again, too, and he's got his own airplane and running 135 with like a Husky doing some contract work for BLM or something like that.
He contacted me. He's running another program with something more than a Husky.
Okay.
He's chief pilot for somebody, I think.
I need to get back to him again.
He's got something going out of Alaska. He asked me if I was interested.
Oh.
And I wasn't.
Yeah, I'll have to talk
but
to him
talk
again.
To him again.
Yeah. So back to the Clearwater, it's marine mammal surveys primarily.
Primarily, yep.
And you're working for, it's based at also Dotna, which is on the Kenai Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
Andy Harcum's the owner, and
yep.
I worked with Andy at Hagland years and years ago. Andy flew for Bering Air here, actually out of Kotzebue as well, so he'd been around a while. And Andy hooked up with the Radiskis,
mm-hmm.
and they've kind of formed this. They've bought out Clearwater
right.
with this primary focus being these marine mammal surveys. So you're working with biologists,
right?
What's kind of what's this job like compared to your other jobs? What's the
this job is. Well, it's a lot of precise flying.
Right.
This is not exciting, with the exception of one survey. the majority of this survey is at 1,000 to 1,200 feet.
Okay.
On airspeed, on altitude, on course. We dial the GPS into 0.30.
Right.
So it's like you're flying a localizer course.
On grid lines.
On grids.
Over the water.
Over the water up to 200 miles out. This is farther than 200 miles out. We actually fly out to Gamble. We got drums of fuel that you flew out there for us.
Them off.
And so we top off out of those 55-gallon drums and then fly out starting along the Russian border and flying up to 300 miles out there.
Oh, wow.
And coming back. So we run some pretty long lines, and this is a seal population survey where we got infrared cameras, digital cameras hooked into a computer system. The SLRs are clicking a photograph every second.
Okay.
And the FLIRs pick up when they pick up, and then they'll correlate the FLIR pickup with where that was, and then they can actually see a picture of what the FLIR picked up.
That's way beyond when the early surveys I was doing, Danny. It was all just biologists looking out the window.
That's our other survey.
Okay.
And this is seal population. And the whale surveys that we'll still do, those are out of Barrow and Dead Horse up by Prudhoe Bay. And those are just biologists looking out the windows with a data recorder in the back and what you see. And same thing, you're flying at an airspeed, at an altitude, flying right along a grid line.
Yeah.
The challenge is, you know, weather out there sometimes, the, you know, keeping an eye on the weather back where you're
want
to get back to, because the weather can come in quick, having an out if it does, where are you going to go? There's more mental stuff going on in this environment than there is yanking and banking and having fun.
Yeah, a lot of it's actually meeting up with, at least for the whale surveys, with the biologists in the morning and discussing what the weather's going to be doing out there. They need certain conditions.
Right, and it's a limiting factor for the whale survey. Once the ice is gone and wind becomes a factor, basically anything more than 15 knots of wind and anything less than a 1,200-foot ceiling, you can't go.
This is western and northwestern Alaska.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of sitting around. The good thing is with this job, you get paid whether you fly or not.
Yep.
So there's no pressure to go out there and do flying in crappy weather that you know, find yourself over your head and locked out of everywhere.
And Andy puts you up in good hotels.
Good hotels. You got decent per diem.
They buy your wife a ticket up to visit?
Well, that's not, I mean, everybody kind of
works
cuts their own deal.
Yeah, but you're the chief pilot.
Yeah.
Well, you've been with him a while.
Yeah, been with him a while, and I get the job done.
Right.
As much as can be possible. I were looking last year comparing my flights to the other guys' flights, and I mean, we were just kicking ass and getting the job done.
Well, it also just ties into, clearly Andy wants to keep you around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's trying to make things more attractive and make it a livable job.
You
want to see Hawaii.
So he flies my wife up. I call it my conjugal visit once a month, and she'll come up and spend a week or so.
Yeah,
and then fly back home.
I mean, that's cool.
She just gets jobs that allow her to take off whenever she wants.
Awesome.
And she's got some side jobs that she does. Billing for an electric company
that she can do online.
Yeah, so she's flexible and that works out pretty good.
So what are you as a chief pilot? You're running two commanders now?
Two commanders, and the company also has...
You've got that single otter.
Well, single otter, which, they don't fly quite as much. They've got a scout on floats.
That's right, yeah.
That they do a little otter survey. Andy pretty much does that most of the time. I think he's looking at hiring somebody to do that too. And a 180 on wheels that they'll do some stuff with.
How involved are you in the hiring, or is Andy kind of, it's a small company?
We, you know, Andy's basically, you know, the head kahuna.
Right.
But my input has weight.
Right.
You know, like if somebody came and I'm going to fly with them and I end up doing most of the training, and you know, if a guy can't hit his ass with both hands, I'm going to say so, and he's probably not going to get hired.
Right, right.
Or if his personality rubs everybody the wrong way, you know, guess what?
And that's a lot of it, because you're hanging out.
You are. You're
at the hotel. And
you're spending a lot of time together, and you know, we've probably all had jobs, and it seems like most jobs, wherever you go, there's always that turd in the punch bowl.
Yeah.
And that's no fun.
Yeah.
And this is a small enough company. Guess what? You know, we don't really have to put up with a turd in a punch bowl.
Yeah. And you work with the same biologist year after year. And
A lot of times, we went through, they did a pretty heavy rotation last year. You know, every week or two, it seems like I met probably 10 new biologists last year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They circulate a bunch through. But a lot of them are the same ones. You know, you're not going to find tons of people that, you know, nobody gets along with everybody.
Right, yeah.
Inside, you can on the surface. I mean, I can get along with anybody.
It's work.
It's work. But for the most part, you know, it's just a good bunch of people, and you have fun. We'll get together and play games in a room afterwards.
Frisbee.
There's Ultimate Frisbee. We come up with a game called Salad Bowl. You know, you get the six of you together or whatever, how many, and crews from the other, like the Otter crew and stuff, and get together with those people too. And
that's cool.
And write a bunch of words and put them all in a bowl, and then you draw. And it's kind of like the first round will be describe the word. You can't use no hand gestures.
Right.
Okay, so this would be, okay, it's a device that can duplicate your voice in a digital format. It's and I'm trying to get you to say a digital voice recorder or whatever. You know?
Right, yeah, yeah.
And then a charade. You can just act it out, but you can't say. And it goes on. But, you know, and it's a lot of fun. You get a bunch of people cracking up.
It's social.
Yeah, it's a social thing. So that's an upside.
Do you have a feel what Andy's looking for when he hires? Yeah, we got to get moving here pretty soon.
He's basically a contract requirements are, you know, they need somebody co-pilot wise with around 2,500 hours, preferably 1,000 hours of PIC time.
Pretty high time.
Multi-engine time. You know, if you need to be able to do the job if a guy croaks 200 miles out to sea.
Yeah, yeah. And really do it.
It's not just a warm body thing.
Right. Probably finish the survey.
Yeah.
He's dead. You might as well
finish. Yeah, you
line.
Might as well finish because he ain't coming back. But I think most of the PIC guys have in excess of 7,000 hours anyway.
Okay. Definitely a higher, and the pay's pretty good.
Yeah, it pays pretty good. When you're on contract, it's I think the co-pilots are 300 a day,
okay,
plus per diem, and the captains are 400 a day plus per diem.
Right,
starting
that's
out,
good.
And hotels paid for. You know, you get your food. What I do, I go to Costco, load up, and take all my food up there with me, and eat out once in a while. But you know, so works
pretty
out
good
pretty
deal.
Good.
I'll have to get Dandy on some more of this too. But you need to go get your plane.
Yep,
ready.
I got to get going.
And we'll see you at the plane, and we'll try to get that video going.
Yeah,
cool. It's Aiden with Oddball Pilots signing off.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.